I'm Mikko Pawlikowski, and this is Hockey Stick. Generative AI is on everyone's mind, from essays to photorealistic pictures to high-quality videos. It has changed the way we think about creativity and intelligence forever. If the AI won't steal your job, but somebody using AI will, then the best defense is to learn how this technology works ASAP. Today, I'm bringing you Mark Liu, the author of Learn Generative AI with PyTorch, a tenured finance professor and the founding director of the Master of Science in Finance program at the University of Kentucky, and a veteran coder with over 20 years of experience. In this conversation, we'll talk about learning through doing, how everybody can build generative AI models, the various breakthroughs that allowed for the current AI explosion to take place, and make some wild predictions about the future. Welcome to this episode, and please enjoy. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Thank you, Mikko. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm very excited, not only because I'm hoping to learn so many interesting things from your book, but also because I'm very curious, how does somebody who's a founding director of a Master of Science in Finance and a tenured professor in finance decide to go into AI? Tell us a little bit about your story.
It goes back to like 5 years ago. In 2017, our department wanted to launch a Master of Science in Finance program. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I've been tenured for about 5 years. I was always very adventurous, trying to do new things. I was appointed the founding director to start an academic graduate program from scratch. And I was very much into it. It was a lot of work, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. So our program launched in fall of 2017, mm-hmm. and it's a one-year mm-hmm. program. At the end of 2017, we started to place our students. The very first year, we had 30 students in the program, which is a great number. And I talked to many employers, many companies, trying to place our MS finance students. I heard the same thing again and again. They told me that they wanted somebody who not only know finance, but also know coding, programming, analytics. And the number one programming language in finance is Python. And I've been doing programming for many years. So those are mainly statistical software to run regression for finance research. And then I had to learn Python from scratch in order to teach my students. And it turns out that Python is a very user-friendly programming language. So even if you never programmed before, you can guess what a block of code is trying to accomplish. I started to run Python workshops to MS finance students, and gradually I accumulated a lot of teaching notes. And I also had to convince my students to use Python, because some of the students said that I can do everything in Excel. Why should I learn Python, right? Mm-hmm. And then I told mm-hmm. them that Excel is not exactly a programming language, and you do need a programming language in order to automate things, to make things more convenient, bigger programs, that kind of stuff. So what I did was I started to create a fun project in finance, like speech recognition and text-to-speech. So one example would be, I add those features to a finance calculator. What you can do is that you can actually speak to a computer and ask the computer to do a finance calculation. You can tell the program in a human voice what is the present value of $1,000 in 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then the program will do the calculation and tell you the answer in a human voice. And then that caught students' attention. So I started to do those kind of applications. And then after a year or so, I had plenty of projects. And then some students told me you should write a book about it. So I started to send the manuscript to No Starch Press to publish the book. The moment my colleagues or my students or a lot of my friends, even my family members, heard that I'm writing a programming book in Python about the speech recognition and the text-to-speech, their first reaction was, I thought you were a finance professor. So that question came up again and again. And then I give them a famous quote by a chief risk officer from Deutsche Bank. Banks are essentially technology firms now. So there is a lot of truth in that, because in order to be in the field of finance, you need to know a lot of technology, no programming, no analytics, and so forth. So that was my first book in 2020. It's finally published in 2021. So I think I signed a contract with them in 2019. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I started to teach a course in the MS Finance program. So it's called Python Predictive Analytics. So we use Python to do machine learning models for business analytics. And I started to teach students a lot of machine learning models, including deep neural networks. And then again, I accumulated a lot of notes. And then I came across a video from DeepMind showing how you can actually play Atari games like Breakout by training a computer program to play the game at a superhuman level. So what happened was not only the computer program learned to play the game, it actually figured out a way to score very efficiently, a way human beings didn't know before. So you dig a tunnel at the side of the wall, and then you send the ball to the back of the wall to score it very efficiently. When I saw that video, I was completely amazed. I told myself, I got to figure out how this works. I spent several months experimented with different kind of programs, trying to figure out how it works. And eventually I figured out. And that came my second book. It's Machine Learning Animated. So it's published with CRC Press last year. And then recently, once ChatGPT was out, generative AI was very popular. I was very curious. I was trying to figure out how exactly a large language model works and how a computer program can understand human language. I spent a lot of time trying to figure it out. Before I was actually using TensorFlow, it worked pretty well for me with Atari games and so on and so forth. Apparently, it's not great in terms of GPU training. You can do GPU training, but there is an overhead. So you have to program everything in CPU and then send it to the GPU, do the calculation, and then send it back. The overhead is just too much. So it ended up not very fast. Then I learned another AI framework called PyTorch. You can explicitly send a tensor to GPU to do the calculation and so on and so forth. It's a little more complicated than TensorFlow because you do have to send something to GPU and then get it back. So in terms of coding, you have to do a slightly more work. But in terms of performance, it's amazing. So I get to train models 7 to 10 times faster compared to CPU training. As all those large language models, they have billions or hundreds of billions of parameters, right?
Yeah.
So the speed is crucial. Right now, I'm like training a model with millions of parameters, which is fine. So for even larger kind of language models, in my third book, which is with many publications. So in this book, I'm doing generative AI with PyTorch. The reason I switched to PyTorch is because of dynamic computing graph and then the GPU training. I can train most models in a matter of minutes. Sometimes like the larger ones, maybe a couple of hours. That's it. I can see the model in action and then I can tune the model. So that's the third book. So let me conclude by quickly summarizing what I'm doing in the third book. The name, I think you just mentioned it at the beginning, Learn Generative AI with PyTorch. Readers learn to create generative AI models from scratch to create the different contents like images, shapes, numbers, text, music, sound, and so forth, all with PyTorch and deep learning models. And in particular, readers learn how to create a ChatGPT style transformer from scratch. And then in particular, I teach readers how to create a GPT-2 XL with 1.5 billion parameters. Of course, with 1.5 billion parameters, it's very hard to train, right? It's very slow, number one. Number two, GPT-2 was trained with huge amounts of data, and the regular readers don't have access to this training data, right? But I also teach readers how to extract the pre-trained weights from OpenAI, and then you load those weights into the GPT-2 model you created from scratch and start to generate the text. So the text you generate is very coherent, without grammar errors. It's amazing. Of course, it's not as powerful as ChatGPT, GPT-4, but a normal person without access to super computing facilities, without access to larger amounts of training data, can create a ChatGPT style deep neural network from scratch and use it to generate text and generate that lifelike music. Is amazing. And that's the text part. On the image part, you can create like a color image. You can also convert a horse to a zebra. You can convert blonde hair to black hair in images. You can add or remove glasses in images, sound, and so forth. So the whole experience is amazing. It worked better than anticipated, and the whole experience reminded me of famous quote, technology advanced enough is indistinguishable from magic. The whole thing is really magic. That's my long answer to your question.
Thank you for that. Just for anybody who's not familiar with Manning, the book is currently available in what's called MEEP. That's for Manning Early Access Program. You can read the chapters as they are produced by Mark. So at the moment, there is 5 chapters that are available, but I'm being told that 11 will be coming very soon. And the estimated time for the whole book to be available is May 2024. So for anybody who's eager and who might be thinking that the book is not finished yet, you can actually start reading it right now. Speaking of the magic and the building from scratch, I think what I liked the most about your book and what initially attracted me to actually go and read it is that build from scratch thing. And I love that you used Richard Feynman's philosophy, the quote, "What I cannot create, I do not understand." I think that's a very good motto to live by. It's absolutely great that you take us on this journey to build things up, even though I've only read the 5 chapters so far. All of a sudden with ChatGPT, everybody started talking about this and this explosion What were some other moments other than ChatGPT where you realized, oh man, this is going to blow up. This is going to be massive with generative AI. I believe you mentioned the Writers Guild of America versus AI story. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Before I answer that question, I encourage you to read my chapter one for free, even if you don't have to buy my book. Mani has a great feature. If you go to mani.com and if you look for my book, Learn Generative AI with PyTorch, you can find it. I have a fairly long chapter one summarizing the state of the art in generative AI and also what I'm doing in the book. What Miko talking about, the Writers Guild of America. So a few months ago, they negotiated with the big firms about the threat of AI. And as a result, it's a contract to limit how much AI you can use in writing, in production, in order to protect the jobs of the writers. And this is just one example of the disruptive power of AI in many different industries. Writers is just one example, and it threatens many other industries. Another example is Checkmate, which is an online educational platform. So college students go there to get a tutoring service and so forth. And with ChatGPT, actually, their business model is threatened, right? I think in the month after the release of ChatGPT, their stock price plunged by almost 40%. So that's how serious the competition is. Those are just a couple of examples. The potential of generative AI is huge, but at the same time, if you don't catch up with the trend, there is a risk that your job might be replaced by AI. There is an interesting quote. I think there is a lot of truth in it. It says that AI will not take your job. Somebody using AI will. So I think there is a lot of truth in that. So in order to avoid being replaced by AI, I think the best strategy is to get in the game, to learn about generative AI, to protect yourself in terms of future careers. So that's the big motivation behind my books. The main motivation, of course, is intellectual curiosity. I'm by nature a very curious person. So when I saw like ChatGPT works like magic, I really want to get to the bottom of it and trying to figure out how it works. So that's the main reason. But at the same time, I'm trying to teach my students programming skills, machine learning skills, AI skills, generative AI skills in order to prepare them for the job market so that in the future, their skill sets will not be outdated. That's my second motivation for writing the books.
Do you buy into this comparison that AI is like personal computers, and that the people were worried about how personal computers were going to just remove jobs. But what ended up happening was some small portion of jobs was eliminated, but most of the jobs were modified and became operating computers. Do you think that's the most apt comparison of what we're likely to experience with AI in the coming years?
The future is hard to predict, but personally, I think most likely that's what's going to happen in the near future. If generative AI, you can actually use it to increase your productivity, to have more job opportunities. On the other hand, if you basically completely stay away from it, your skill sets might be outdated. But at the same time, I think technology will make all this like AI stuff more accessible to most people, right? You don't necessarily have to be a programmer. So one example is Midjourney, right? So you can actually just go to a browser and then you can use Midjourney or DALL-E 2, DALL-E 3 or whatever to create very fancy images. You can use a text prompt to create an image of what you meant. You don't have to draw yourself. In that sense, I'm optimistic. I think for most people, generative AI will be a very valuable tool to increase their productivity, as long as you keep up with the technology.
I'm glad you mentioned Midjourney, because I think for me personally, that was when I realized, okay, this is the hockey stick moment. Because I remember the little tiny pictures, blurry from the gun paper. And then all of a sudden, I saw some pictures that were generated by Midjourney, and I went and I tried it myself. And it was more or less able to produce almost everything I threw at it, other than some particular types of dinosaurs that just didn't recognize. That was like the one thing I knew. Okay, they didn't train it on that kind of dinosaur. But that was definitely one of those moments where I realized, wow. And the other is, I think I live in London. One way or another, you end up using the tube a lot. And usually you're annoyed at people who play some music on like public transport. And then at some point, I realized that I was getting annoyed at people talking about generative AI on the public transport and making noise. Okay. And that's when you realize that, okay, so this has now gone mainstream and everybody's talking about that. But let's talk a little bit about the actual underlying breakthroughs that brought us to where we are. And in particular, I'm thinking about GAN, the generative adversarial networks, and transformers and diffusion. Where should we start? Okay. What's the first important breakthrough that everybody should know about?
I think all the generative AI models in my book are deep neural networks. Machine learning is a very wide field. There are many traditional machine learning models, random forest, linear regressions, this and that. But about 20 years ago, deep neural networks became very powerful. But one great thing about the neural networks is that you can scale it. And the deep neural network can approximate any relationship, even if we human beings don't know what's the exact relationship, as long as you create a large enough model to capture it. So that's the foundation 20 years ago. And then over the past 20 years or so, many big breakthroughs in deep learning field. And then let's talk about ChatGPT, okay? So ChatGPT is a huge deep neural network trained on huge amounts of data. And before that, state of the art, natural language processing models or recurrent neural networks. So how it works was it progresses on the timeline. Let's say you have a sentence, like this is a sentence, right? So you have like four words in the sentence, right? The model uses the first word, this, to predict that the second word is, and then it uses the first two words to predict the third word and so on and so forth. It worked to some degree, but it's very slow because you have to predict one word at a time. And then in 2017, there is a huge breakthrough. There's a paper called Attention is All You Need by a group of Google scholars. And they used a different mechanism to capture the relationship of different words in a sentence. So it's called the attention mechanism. And it's much more effective. On top of that, it's not sequential. So which means one word can pay attention to all other words at the same time. And this allows for parallel training. And this has huge implications. Number one, it works better in terms of capturing long-term relationships between different words in a sentence so that you can understand the meaning of a long sentence, long text, number one. Number two, because of the long sequential nature attention mechanism, you can use parallel training. You can train the same model on many different devices. This makes training much faster. And this also allows you to train the model on more data. That's why ChatGPT became so powerful, because you can train it much faster, and then you can train it on more data. On top of that, the mechanism works much better than recurrent neural networks, because it can capture really, really long-term relationships in a sequence, like as a text is a sequence, right? That propelled OpenAI to have all these models, including ChatGPT. Now, let's go to the recent development, the text to image transformers. This is a new innovation in transformer models called multimodal models. The original transformer model, attention is all you need, which powers ChatGPT. They only use text, right? So the input is a sequence of text. The output is also a sequence of text. But the multimodal models, the input and output can be different formats, right? DALL-E 2, DALL-E 3, the input is a text, and the output is an image, right? You can have different inputs, outputs, you can have audio, you can have video, Sora basically has video, that kind of stuff. But let's talk about what is the underlying mechanism behind multimodal models, DALL-E 2, DALL-E 3. It has something to do with diffusion models. So I think you mentioned that at first, the generated image is very grainy, right? Diffusion models add noise to an image gradually. Let's say it's all like 1,000 time steps. And then at each time step, you can actually add a little bit of noise to the image. And gradually, you have 1,000 different images. And each one becomes progressively noisier. And at the end, it becomes completely noise. And then what you can do is that you can give those images to a machine learning model, and you can train the model to remove those noises progressively, step by step. That's how DALL-E and all those text-to-image models work. First step is that you use a text prompt to generate a very grainy image. And then after that, you use a model, which is very much like diffusion models. You will progressively refine those models so that you turn a very grainy image into a high resolution image. That's why when you enter a short prompt, and then DALL-E 2 can give you a high resolution image capturing what you're trying to produce in the text prompt. So that's actually chapter 14 of my book. I'm going to talk about how you can add a little bit of noise to the image one step at a time, and then you can use those images to train the model to remove the noise step by step progressively, and very much like DALL-E 2 trying to make the image clearer and clearer step by step progressively.
Right. And then we also got the generative adversarial networks, which was an interesting development from Ian Goodfellow. How does that fit into the rest of what you just described?
Generative adversarial networks. So it's great at generating different forms of content, right? A lot of times when readers learn something, if you give them the end product, it's too complicated, right? So they may get frustrated and they just give up. Okay. As an author, my job is how to make sure readers stay engaged throughout the book and they never get tired, never get frustrated, and they gradually learn and finally learn to do the state of the art, machine learning models, generative AI models like ChatGPT style, transformer to generate text and audio, right? So what is the idea behind GANs? You have two networks. One is a generator network. The other one is a discriminate network. So the job of the generator is trying to generate a piece of work similar to that from the training data set. Let's use a grayscale image as an example, right? You have a training data set of grayscale images of handwritten digits, like 0 to 9. And then those are the real images. And then you will ask the generator to generate something similar to that so that it can pass as real in front of the discriminator. Okay. Before you train the model, the generator is terrible. So whatever the generator generated, it's completely like a gibberish. It's like a flown snake on a screen, that kind of stuff. But this is where training comes in. You will have a training loop, and then in each iteration, you will ask the generator to generate a bunch of fake images. At the same time, you also have a bunch of real images from the training set, and you give all of those to the discriminator and ask the discriminator to determine whether each image is real or fake. And then generator's job is trying to create an image so that the discriminator would think it's real. That's the generator's objective. So therefore, you have a loss function, and then you train the model. You gradually fine-tune the model parameters so that in the next iteration, whatever image generated by the generator will have a higher probability of passing as real. And then you do this again and again. You can do it thousands of iterations. And if you do that long enough, then eventually the generator will be able to create an image identical to the image from the training set. So that's how GAN works. You have a zero-sum game. You have a competitive kind of two networks competing with each other, trying to outsmart each other, and eventually the generator gets better and better. So that's the idea behind GANs. It's a revolutionary idea in 2014-2015. Ian Goldfinger and his co-authors proposed the model. A great thing about the model is it can generate different content, numbers, images, shapes, even music, sound, and so forth.
I love this idea because on top of that, you've got this built-in target point, right? When your discriminator can no longer discriminate between what you're generating. When you're finished, it's not arbitrary. You've got that. And the other reason why I love that is that it's got this anecdote attached to it that legend has it. It was written one evening when Ian was celebrating in a pub. I think someone was graduating, some fellow students, and they were discussing a problem when they wanted to generate some pictures. And he came up with this idea that, oh, what you're suggesting is too complicated. You should put two networks against each other. And they laughed. Mm-hmm. He went home and still slightly drunk. He wrote a proof of concept of that. And then turned out that it actually worked out. I think one of the interviews later, he said that if he wasn't drunk, he probably wouldn't have done it because it sounded like a silly idea.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
How random some of those things are. How weird and unpredicted. And I think one of the things I wanted to ask you about is also what made all of those kind of recent breakthroughs possible? What was missing? Because we've had the neural network since, the 80s or something like that. All of a sudden, it looks like in the last few years, or maybe last decade or so, it was just like one breakthrough after another breakthrough just dropping. And if you try to keep up with currently written papers on AI, there's just so many of them. And it looks like every other day, there's something super interesting that's been developed. And it's literally hard to keep up just with other people's ideas. What do you think enabled this kind of explosion in the recent years?
Actually, neural networks was proposed even earlier than 1980s. I think in 1960s, researchers proposed the artificial neural networks, basically modeled after human brain. The idea was a great one. But at that point, we didn't have the hardware to support it. And then started in 1990s, early 2000s, the hardware becomes much more powerful, number one. Number two, there were more research, more breakthroughs in the research field of artificial neural networks. So one example is Lacoon's convolutional neural networks. Most neural networks are fully connected dense neural networks, which means a neuron in the previous layer is connected to all the neurons in the next layer. And it works great, except that once your model becomes larger, the number of parameters grow exponentially, and then it's very hard to train it, right? So that's a problem. Convolutional neural networks is you localize the weights, okay? You have a filter, and then the weights in the filter is fixed. When you move the filter on an image, and then this will greatly reduce the number of parameters. It makes computer vision much more efficient. Because of that, in early 2000s, there were a lot of breakthroughs in computer vision, in convolutional neural networks. And I think that's a huge breakthrough. And then after that, you also have GPU training. GPU training became very popular in the past maybe 10 years or so, and a huge game changer, because as deep neural networks became larger and larger, it's very hard to train them without extra help, right? When you train on CPU. CPU basically is a general purpose kind of processor. You have to do many things on it, but the GPU is specialized, so you can do machine learning jobs much faster. And of course, we also have more and more training data available, and that also is necessary for large language models to work. It takes time, but I think the past 20 years or so, we suddenly have everything came together to make it work.
Basically, we've got gamers to thank for the breakthroughs in AI because of the graphic cards, the GPUs that they requested, right?
They have a very good point. I think a GPU was originally designed for gaming purpose, right? And then suddenly right now, it has a completely different purpose. And I have several GPUs at home, not very powerful. I think it's powerful enough for me to experiment on different models. It costs maybe several hundred dollars, $1,000. I have three of them. Two of them are from my son. My son was playing video games, and then now he doesn't use those computers anymore, and then he just give it to me, and then I just simply take them out and use it for now. But the cost is not that much.
The cost is not that much unless you go for like the top of the line, 80 gig ones, which are very hard to come by and also quite expensive. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So thank you, gamers. Thank you for enabling the AI revolution in many ways. It goes back to what I was saying about how random some of these things seem to be. So where do you think we're heading? Like you said, future is notoriously difficult to predict, obviously. But if you were still going to venture and make a guess that will probably prove completely wrong a few years down the line, where do you think we're heading with all of this?
If I had to venture to guess, the large language models will become even more powerful in the near future. Not only in terms of generating cohesive text, but also generating images, generating videos, and also modal models will become very popular. Okay, you can generate not only images, text, you can also generate audio, video, sound, and so forth. Other than that, I think it really depends on which breakthrough will come through in the near future. And you never know, maybe there's just one day suddenly there is a huge breakthrough and then it will completely change the landscape of AI. just like what ChatGPT did a couple of years ago, right? The future is very exciting, but at the same time, like you said, it's very hard to predict. But I think right now is a very fortunate time, a very exciting time for tech enthusiasts, for anybody who is passionate about AI, about technology. It's very exciting.
So two follow-up questions then. One, it's like anything else, there are these fashion waves that kind of come and go, and AI is now the latest, hottest thing. So all the VCs, everybody's throwing money at it. But at some point, people will probably move on to the next thing, just like they did with crypto and smartphones and internet and whatever else before, right? So I'm wondering, where do you think we are in that hype cycle, and what's going to happen when all of a sudden slapping AI first on your startup no longer makes sure that you get funding? So that's question number one, follow up. And then the second question is, if you were to plot a graph of how you expect the large language models to continue developing, I think we can all agree that there is some kind of like very exponential growth where somebody figured out ChatGPT or one of these massive models. If you throw enough data at it and you massage it for long enough, you can create this impression of, oh, this is magic. How on earth is that even happening? But then at some point it has to plateau, right? It's not possible for it to go at that kind of speed into the sky.
Feeling, again, it's hard to predict the sense.
Of course, all the usual disclaimers about predictions. But what's your take on what it means about us as humans? Does it mean that what we cherish as one of the unique capabilities of humans, the human intelligence, is not actually all that unique? Because it's hard to not have this feeling when you talk to one of those big large language models, and during the time it doesn't go haywire and start behaving weird, but on the times where it works well, it's really hard to not have this impression that you're talking to somebody with some amount of intelligence to it. So does it mean that we're all some kind of statistical models and the intelligence that we demonstrate is also an emerging property? What's your take on that?
I don't think many people in the world right now have a good answer to that question. That said, I do want to point out that there are many people right now have concerns about AI because of the potential damage it can do. So it's all about the objective function. So if you give a task to the model and in terms of the loss function, and then you can just train it again and again, and eventually it will become very good, whatever objective you want the model to do. So that is good, but at the same time, it can be bad. The AI may not even know it, right? It's just trying to accomplish a certain goal. It just happens that a human being stand in the way of that goal. So in that sense, I do think that the human beings need to be careful. I think like AI needs to be regulated to some degree. We cannot let it to do whatever it wants. It may have serious negative consequences to human beings.
I think that a lot of what you just described has been the main kind of concern for everybody making sci-fi movies, from the Terminator and Skynet. And I certainly get that, but I think I'm probably more worried about going back to what we said about you won't be losing your job to AI, you'll be losing your job to someone using an AI. And I think this probably applies here too, that you can just do as an enabler, it scales up the amount of damage that nefarious party can actually produce. Because using that to bad ends, a lot of the security that we rely on is practical, right? Like, for example, all the encryption keys that we use for everything are only because it would be computationally too expensive to actually figure that out. But then when you got tools like this, it's easy to be scared about the possibility of that figuring out and making things possible that previously weren't. So I think I'm more worried about that scenario where someone uses the AI to bad ends and it enables them to do more damage than they would be able to do with traditional methods.
And in the current stage, if AI falls into the wrong hands, it can do a lot of damage. Not that catastrophic, but it can do a lot of damage to a lot of families, right? I think there were like stories about people use generative AI to create a fake phone call to their parents and demand a ransom money. So I think it causes financial damage and also a lot of emotional distress, like fake news, fake video, a lot of deep fake stuff. So even at this stage, I think you can do a lot of harm if you fall into the wrong hands.
Yeah, that's a very good example of the call. Like, you can technically go and call people and scam, and people do that. Mm-hmm. But there is a limit to how many people you can physically call in a day. If on the other hand, you have a powerful enough AI, you can scale it up and you can probably call everybody in the United States a certain amount of time. Are you concerned about the AI involvement in the upcoming election?
So we have to be careful, but I think so far the impact is limited. But at the same time, I think all the parties, politicians need to pay attention to generative AI because of what it can do, fake news and so forth. And imagine you are running a political campaign, right? You must get to know analytics, how AI can influence your campaign either positively or negatively. If your team can utilize AI to strengthen your position legally, you're in a very good position. It can help you. But on the other hand, if you're not careful, your opponents or somebody can use deepfake to disrupt your campaign for your cause. That's why I think AI is so powerful and also so widespread. It affects every single industry in the economy, not just a few isolated sectors. That's very unique about AI.
Did you hear about the Elon Musk lawsuit against OpenAI from a few days ago? Mm-hmm. Obviously, OpenAI initially started as an alternative to the big companies and their massive labs like Google, Facebook, and so on. And their pitch and the initial mission statement was to release everything open source. Now, hence the name, OpenAI. And then somewhere along the way, that turned, and it's currently a for-profit, closed source company worth, under $100 billion at the moment. We're recording this on March the 4th. A few days ago, Elon Musk opened this lawsuit where he alleges that he was basically scammed because they turned the company around and they went against the initial mission. And I think the opinions on the internet vary from, okay, this is a jealousy because he's jealous of the success that OpenAI has seen, to, okay, this is a nice publicity stunt. He probably has a point, but this is probably not going to stand in court. And I'm, you know, trying to make sense of how much of that is actually valid and how much I should be worried about OpenAI being at the forefront of this, a big closed source company.
I also heard that many years ago when Elon Musk and Sam Altman co-founded OpenAI, their objective was a nonprofit organization. Given the competition from other big players in the industry, I think OpenAI was under pressure to commercialize ChatGPT, and this may go against the original objective. So I can see the argument from both sides. On the one hand, we have to be careful, like we just discussed, about the use of AI. It may need to the end of humanity as we know it, if we're not careful. But at the same time, if used properly, it can be a great tool. That's why there is such a great market for generative AI. So I think there is some tension in the company, so you have different views. That's why I think a few months ago, within several days, Sam Altman was fired and then get hired back and so on and so forth. In the background, I think it's really this, those two forces at play. So the force wants to make sure that AI does not go out of control, harm human beings. And at the same time, it's huge pressure from industry peers to commercialize those applications to make profits. Actually, I'm glad that Elon Musk actually made the lawsuit in the sense that it may swing the pendulum to the other side. So eventually, I think the view that we should commercialize and make money out of it, I think that kind of view prevailed, right? That's why Sam Altman got hired back. But that can go too far because in the process of competition, making profits, you may sacrifice security. So I think the lawsuit by Elon Musk can potentially put the original mission in check, so to speak, and maybe force OpenAI and other tech companies to think more about guardrails around AI to make sure it doesn't go out of control and harm human beings.
Time will tell if anything comes out of it other than one billionaire being upset at another, but we'll see. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you for one more prediction, and this time a little bit more down to earth. PyTorch, it appears to be still on the rise, and it appears to be the kind of go-to option for any new papers. TensorFlow seems to be stagnating a little bit. You talked a little bit about the advantages of PyTorch and why you chose it for your book. And I'm wondering, do you see this being like the prevailing platform? Because now I think that the main kind of breakthroughs for PyTorch was, you mentioned the GPU support, obviously, and also the built-in backpropagation, right, the AutoGrad. Now the other frameworks also provide the AutoGrad, so I guess they're closing up the gap a little bit in that respect. If you were to venture one more crazy prediction, would you see PyTorch leading the way going forward, or are you going to update your book in a couple of years to port it to some other framework?
I think PyTorch is going to prevail in the near future. So I mentioned this in my book. So what PyTorch does is using a dynamic computational graph, which means it creates notional graph on the fly so that it's faster, it's more flexible. TensorFlow is using static computational graph, so it's slower. So that's the main difference, and it affects the training speed greatly. So in TensorFlow, you don't really have to worry about which device you're going to use. It's all done at the back end automatically by TensorFlow. But at the cost, if you have industry scale models, and then you have a lot of GPU and you do a huge calculation, maybe the overhead is negligible, it doesn't affect sense much. But for a lot of researchers, it makes a huge difference because we are already working with a lot of toy models, not huge. Therefore, if you use PyTorch, there is a little bit of inconvenience in the sense that you have to specify whether to move this tensor to GPU. And then once you are done with it, you have to get it back. But the benefit is huge because it greatly increases the training speed. I think like at least for small players, regular readers, and also for researchers around the world, I think PyTorch is much more convenient, it's much faster. And certain large corporations, they may not care that much. For regular people, PyTorch is much more convenient, it's much faster, and in the near term, it may win out.
For anybody listening to this, I know that if I haven't read your book before, I would probably be on manning.com looking at it. And then at some point I would reach chapter 4, where you're walking us through building a network that does generation of anime faces, which I thought was a pretty cool example. Can you give us a taste for anybody who's going to be doing that? What's the training going to look like? What data we're going to use? How we're going to implement a network? And then in terms of training, what kind of hardware you need for the training to be quick? How much time you need to see for that? Give us an idea whether this is something that someone who is comfortable with Python can just pick up on a Sunday on a random weekend and go through, or whether there's any extra prep that's needed.
In order to train a GAN model to produce color images of anime faces, obviously you need the training data, right? So research community has a lot of human curated data for us to experiment on. So you can actually go to a website, download the anime faces, I think tens of thousands of them. And then you need to create two neural networks. One is the generator, one is the discriminator. And the generator is trying to create an image that can pass as real in front of the discriminator. You just train the model many rounds, and then eventually you will see that the generator is able to generate an anime face, which is very much the one from the training set. I want to mention that in order to generate the color images of human faces, you do need to use convolutional neural networks, because we mentioned this earlier. So if you use fully connected dense neural networks, there are just too many parameters, and then the training will be too slow. So on the other hand, if you use convolutional neural networks, you localize the weights. So the weights will stay the same in a filter, and then you move the filter around the image. So this will greatly reduce the number of parameters in the model and make the model training much faster. This is on the software side, on the training side. In terms of hardware, so I trained it using GeForce RTX 2060 like a GPU. I think right now the cost $300 or $400. It's not that expensive. You can easily buy it. Or if you have an older gaming computer, you can just grab it and then put on your computer. It's very easy to do. You don't really need a lot of knowledge about computer hardware to do it. Nowadays, computers are very user-friendly. Pop it open and change ports, that kind of stuff. So it took me like 30 minutes to 1 hour to train the model. So it's very fast. However, if you don't really want to bother with the GPU, you can train the same model with the CPU. And what you can do is you can simply leave your computer on overnight. It may take 5, 6, or 7 hours, but it can be easily done overnight. You just, leave the program on, go to sleep, next morning, you see the result. So in that sense, computationally, it's not that costly. I think the most complicated model would be chapter 6. You have to convert like a horse image into a zebra image. It's called the CycleGAN. And then you have to convert like a blonde hair to black hair in images, or black hair to blonde hair. Those kind of models is a little bit more time consuming, because you are using higher resolution, number one. Number two, you are actually training two generators and two discriminators. Okay, so how CycleGAN works is that you have two generators. Let's use a horse and a zebra as an example, how to convert a horse image to a zebra image, right? So you have two generators. One generator is called a horse generator, the other one is called a zebra generator. So what the horse generator does is it takes in a zebra image and convert it into a horse image. And then what the zebra generator does is that it will take a horse image and convert it into a zebra. And then you also have two discriminators. The horse discriminator will tell whether an image is a horse image or not. And then the zebra discriminator will tell if an image is a zebra image or not. And then CycleGAN has another element. The loss function has a component called CycleLoss. So what do you do? So I think the idea is really ingenious. That's why I mentioned that with the right loss function, you can achieve anything. Originally, you have a horse image, right? And then you give that image to a zebra generator to create a fake zebra image. Okay, now you will use that fake zebra image as input to the horse generator and ask the horse generator convert the fake zebra image into a fake horse image. Now, here is the key. If both generators does their job right, then the fake horse image you got will be identical to the original horse image. So that's called a CycleGAN. So CycleLoss is trying to minimize the loss between the original horse image and the fake horse image after a round trip. That's a very powerful tool because that forces the model, both models, both the zebra generator and the horse generator, to generate realistic images. So since your show is called Hockey Stick, I think that's like when I was like trying to experiment the different models, I think that it's pretty much like a hockey stick moment. When I saw that, I was like, this is like a CycleLoss is really ingenious because that component in the loss function is crucial for you to successfully convert a horse image into a zebra and a zebra image into a horse. When I saw that, I was completely amazed, not just by how well the model works, but also by the engineer's mechanism devised by the researchers. Again, there are tons of smart people in the profession. So sometimes when I see what they are doing, and once I understand what they are doing, I was completely amazed. I said, this method is amazing. The author must be a genius. I think there are tons of engineers in our profession.
Love that story. And also, FYI, I'm totally stealing the quote from you: with the right loss function, you can achieve anything. I think this should go on a t-shirt.
That's right, yeah. With the right loss function, you can achieve anything. That's my belief. The concept of the loss function is very powerful. You know? So loss function is another way of saying the objective function, right? You are telling the model what to achieve, what to do. It's very powerful. Yeah.
I think what keeps striking me is that once you go and look into these ideas, they're not actually that complicated. There's not too much magic in it, but to come up with that idea initially, be the first one to propose that, it does require certainly a level of genius. So I think probably decades from now, kids will be learning a lot of that stuff in primary school or early in their education. And it just feels like we're really experiencing some kind of breakthrough in this profession, a hockey stick moment.
Absolutely. It's good that a lot of smart researchers are working in the field. And sometimes when you get stuck on a question, you may work on it for years, right, without any breakthrough. And then suddenly, once you like struck down it year after year, suddenly there is an aha moment. And then you figure out the way to tackle the problem, and it worked. And then the method may become revolutionary. It may completely change the field.
You're about to finish your book. Is there anything that you would do differently if you were starting to write it today? Would you make any different choices?
G- Good question. I don't think there are many things I would change. The reason is because even though it's a new book, actually I have been working on it for a couple of years now. So I have a GitHub repository before I submit a proposal to Manning's. So it's my way of working things out. A couple of years ago, I started to use PyTorch for machine learning models, and I started to get into generative AI, and then I started to use PyTorch to generate shapes, images, and then eventually I get into natural language processing, large language models, and then I had a lot of projects on my computer. Writing book is my way of organizing things, to think things through, to make sure everything works out. But I know that in order to write a compelling proposal, I need to first prepare well, right? Especially there are not too many good publishers out there. So you only have one shot with a good publisher. Like Manning is one of the great publishers. Over the years, I've read many books from Manning, and I really enjoyed their books. And I knew that I needed to write a good proposal in order to work it out. I don't want to blow the chance. So what I did was in the summer, I spent the several months to create a huge GitHub repository. So I lay out all the chapters initially, like the first draft, and it had 17 chapters. And each chapter, I use a Jupyter notebook to explain everything to the best of my ability. All the codes are there. So it's pretty much like a book. Once I have that, then I spend another month to convert it into an actual book, a PDF file. A lot of tech people use LaTeX. LaTeX is basically a word processing software, right? Especially if you have a lot of math, you can actually generate like a beautiful equation. My book has some like an equation, some math, but not a whole lot. But the forces me to go through everything one more time in the process of converting the GitHub repository into a PDF file. I spent another month converting everything. And also it looks beautiful because it looks exactly like a book. You have a template, you have a cover, you have table of content, you have each chapter, what is section number, what is section title, what is subsection title, so on and so forth. You have images. In short, it's pretty much like a book to be published. And then I send that to Manny in the summer, along with the PDF file, along with the proposal file. And then I have a link to the GitHub page. And then what Manny did was send the book proposal to more than 10 reviewers in the profession. The reviewers are all data scientists, people who know AI in the profession, and they give comments on whether this book should be published, and then they give a lot of very valuable feedback. The feedback was very positive, partly because it's a hot topic, partly because I spent a lot of time preparing it, right? Mm-hmm. But I did receive a lot of good feedback. To answer your question is, because I have been through it several rounds, now, there are not much I would change because I have already incorporated some feedbacks, great feedbacks from about the 12 reviewers on the proposal.
Fair enough. How many copies have you sold so far?
It's already sold more than 1,000 copies. I think like the daily high was 58. So it says a lot about the demand for generative AI. And if you look at the top 10 from Manning website every week, you will see generative AI is hot. a lot of demand. And another trend is Python and PyTorch. I think that's a lot of people are switching to PyTorch. And I think there is a book from Manning called Deep Learning with PyTorch. It's selling very well. And then there's another book called Large Language Models from Scratch. Actually, the book is also using PyTorch, just as I do. But that book focuses just on large language models. But my book focuses on many different contents, like large language models, music, images, shapes, numbers, so on. And then another thing I want to mention is that I did spend a lot of time thinking about how to help readers learn progressively, step by step. Chapter one, of course, is an overview of the book, of the generative AI landscape, and what the book is trying to accomplish. Chapter two is deep learning with PyTorch. So even if readers have no background using PyTorch, after reading chapter two, they will be able to use PyTorch to create deep learning models from A to Z. You have like end to end. You can do the whole thing, okay? So that's very important. And then chapter three, we get into GANs. So you will use GANs to generate numbers and the shapes. So the models are very simple. You only have two or three layers of neurons in those models. So therefore, it's very easy to understand. It's easy to create. And training takes a matter of minutes. Readers will not get frustrated because everything is so simple. And then in chapter four, I kick things up a notch. So instead of using fully connected dense layers, I use convolutional layers. That's needed for image processing if you want to create high resolution color images. Fully connected dense layers won't work. It may work, but it's very slow. On the other hand, if you use convolutional layers, it's much faster because you use a filter to move around the image, and then you just train the weights in the filter. That's much more efficient, that kind of stuff. And then, so people learn to use convolutional layers in chapter four to generate the color image. And then in chapter five, I kick things up another level. So readers learn to select characteristics in images. You can choose to generate an image with eyeglasses or without eyeglasses. You can transition from an image with glass to an image without glasses. So all those arithmetic kind of stuff. And then chapter six is not out yet, but I will do the CycleGAN is computationally costly because of the reason I just mentioned, because they have two generators, two discriminators. And then chapter seven is about variational autoencoders. That's a different model from GAN, but it's important because it has a encoder-decoder kind of architecture, which is very common in machine learning models. For example, ChatGPT is like a decoder-only model. The original transformer paper attention is all you need, has like an encoder part and a decoder part, that kind of stuff. And then after that, I get into transformers, natural language processing, how to do tokenization, how to create a transformer from scratch, including like a ChatGPT style. You can create a GPT from scratch. You can train it. I saw that you have several posts on LinkedIn about how to create a GPT from scratch, right? My book does exactly that in chapter 10. How to create a GPT from scratch. And then chapter 11 is how to create a small GPT from scratch and then train it to generate text. Its focus is not mainly on creating, but on training a GPT from scratch. Of course, it's much smaller. It only has 5 million parameters, but you learn how to train a model from scratch. And then after that, it's music generation, and then diffusion models, and then how you can use LangChain to chain together different large language models. So that's the whole book.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I'm personally super excited. I can't wait until the rest of the chapters become available. So, you know, hurry up. But yeah. Before I let you go, I'm curious whether you have your next idea for your next book already in mind, or whether you're going to take a small break before book number four.
So far, I'm very busy with writing the current book. I do get ideas from time to time. One example is, I think this is a text to image, like a multimodal model thing is amazing. I think there could be another book there, just focus purely on diffusion models and multimodal transformers, how to convert a text to image or convert text to video. There could be a book there. I thought about it, but I didn't spend a lot of time on it because I'm busy writing the current book. And the other idea I thought about is, so this is also related to multimodal models. My first book is called Make Python Talk, right? But it's actually using Google API to do the actual speech recognition, text-to-speech. I don't do any machine learning part, so I just use the Google API to do all the heavy lifting. But there are like open source models out there. You can actually train a model to do speech recognition. So that's actually a multimodal model, right? Because speech recognition, basically the input is audio, output is text, right? And then you can also do text to speech. It can be another interesting project. I have some ideas on how they work, but I do have to spend a lot of time to experiment. So I would say in another 2 or 3 years, I may venture into one of those ideas and maybe write another book about it.
Awesome. You're going to have one reader already interested in that. So definitely go for it.
Okay, let me ask you then, which idea do you like better? The speech recognition model or just a book about text-to-image, multimodal transformer? Which idea do you like better?
I've been meaning to properly read the Whisper paper. So I think the speech recognition is actually a pretty good use case. Okay. I'll definitely be interested in reading that.
Good to know. I may put more emphasis on that project. Awesome. I do like the feedback.
All right. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And hopefully I'll get you next time with your next book. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you.